Hello and welcome to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show with our events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is our 557th show of ROI, and our guest for today is Kelly Rundell, documentary filmmaker, and we're going to be talking about the film that he made just recently, Lost Nation, The Iowa. Joining us for the second segment of our show will be our history buffs, Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. So, first of all, Kelly, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much.
We are excited to have you here. Our first segment is called Farouk Dinaran. The goal is to give our listeners a little bit of background. So let's start off with something I hope is basic, which is why you decided to make a film about the Iowa.
Like most people, we didn't know anything about the Iowa. There is a state named for them. You right. would think we would know. Tammy's from my wife, who's the co-producer on the project. She's from Waterloo, Iowa. So she learned that in school, right? She's shaking her head. No, she did not. And I didn't learn that here in the Quad Cities attending United Township High School. But we had completed our first documentary, which was a 10-year journey while doing other things, working full-time, Villisca, Living with a Mystery. And we showed that film in Red Oak, Iowa, and a woman who saw it there got in touch and said, we should do a film on the Iowa. And that's kind of how it started. So we did some initial research and discovered that not only was this an important Iowa story and an important Midwestern story, but it was an important American history story that most people didn't know.
Yeah, right. Well, so let's start breaking that down a little bit. Can you give us a 3-minute Iowa history lesson? when they came into the area, how long they were here, where did they tend to locate, where the population centers, those kinds of things, just to give people a little sense of who these folks were.
Yes, and before I do that, just a disclaimer, we Tammy and I don't speak for the Iowa people. We are filmmakers, and we were very privileged to be able to tell just a small part of their story in the three films that we made between 2005 and 2013. But in that first film, we focus on a period that begins perhaps around the early 1600s with first contact with Europeans, and the story continues until, let's say, the early 1830s, when Native people are removed from the state of Iowa. So we deal also in the film with the ancestors of the Iowa, a culture that archaeologists call the Oneota. Mm-hmm. And so that is a period, let's say, from 1000 to around 1600. And then that group, Oneota, splits up into various tribes, including the Iowa. So the Iowa were in that era in northeast Iowa. And then if you think of their movements in the state as being on a clock, they're moving counterclockwise around the edges of the state. And the territory that the Iowa thought of as theirs was as far north as Pipestone, Minnesota, where they were the stewards of the Pipestone quarries, and all the way south between the Mississippi and the Missouri rivers to St. Louis. So that includes a big swath, I guess, of what's southern Minnesota, the entire state of Iowa, and northern Missouri.
Okay. So do we have any sense at all of a general population? And if there are particular areas that tended to be occupied, or were these folks purely nomadic and we just don't have enough archaeological or historical information to really get a sense of how large? Because the reason I ask the question is because we have in our heads the Indian tribes we tend to know are the Iroquois, the Comanche, or, they're big tribes over, yep. And so I'm sure people are thinking to themselves, well, okay, how do the Iowa compare to those kinds of groups?
They're much smaller, and we're smaller all along, in a sense. And we don't know, you know, with it's the same with a lot of all native people, in a sense. We don't know what the populations were before contact, and then you have disease and things which are really diminishing those groups significantly. So historic, at least in the historic period, we have figures that are perhaps between 1,500 and 2,000. But that's also a lot of territory to be sort of under the stewardship of a very small group. The Iowa call the Winnebago or the Ho-Chunk their grandfathers, and so there's a cultural connection there. They're also linguistically connected to the Oto and Missouri tribes. So that's what we know about the numbers. Occupation sites, there are a number, I guess, around the state. We've visited many of those locations. They're in northeast Iowa. They're in around Spirit Lake. They're up in the far northwest county, Lyon County, Iowa, which was in the 1640s. That site up there was the largest city in what's now the United States of America. Their last sort of big village occupation site was in near Eldon, Iowa. That was later a white man's town called Iowaville, and on the Des Moines River. And that was a 60-year or so occupation site, so pretty long-time occupation there. And that was just before kind of that was the beginning of the end of the Iowa in the state of Iowa.
All right. Well, we have a lot more to talk about, so please stay tuned for the next segment of our show. This is ROI on KALA St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
In times of joy, in moments of grief, broadcasters come through, even when all else fails. Today, with more ways than ever to experience the moments that transform our lives, Americans still choose broadcast radio and television more than all other media combined. We are the local broadcasters of radio and television, reaching more people, touching more lives. Brought to you by the National Association of Broadcasters and this station.
Hello and welcome back to ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant, the radio show where the events of history are examined through the discussion of books, journal articles, papers, and presentations. Then historians and history buffs ask the question, what is relevant or irrelevant in today's world? My name is Jay Swords. This is the second segment of the show, referred to as the Kitchen Table. Our guest for today is Kelly Rundle, documentary filmmaker, and we're talking about his film series, Lost Nation, The Iowa. Our history buffs for today are Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. Terry, why don't you start us off?
Okay. Yes, Kelly, I'd like to know more about how the Iowa tribe governed their people. Were their clans, were they large groups, small groups, spread out throughout Iowa? You said they had covered a big territory. So how did they govern each other?
Well, you are correct. They had a clan structure, and rather than having a single leader, they had a leader of each clan. They had clans who were designated as sort of the leaders, and they would exchange that responsibility twice a year. So the Bear Clan would take charge in the fall and winter, and then in the spring, either with the sound of the first thunder or the croaking of a particular tree frog, then the leadership would go to the Buffalo Clan. So it was clan leadership, and that was one of the things that the U.S. government honed in on when there was, when they were trying to get land from Native people. So the idea was to designate someone as a chief, and then you only have one person to work with instead of a leader from each of the clans. Where normally they would be reaching decisions via consensus.
Sure. Ed.
Yeah, thanks, Jay. Kelly, what kind of lifestyle did the Iowa practice? I would assume that some of them were more or less sedentary, and then others were hunter-gatherers. And did the buffalo factor into this?
Yeah, so I should issue another disclaimer here. I probably know a lot more about the Iowa than the average person. But there are limits to what I know about all Native people and those cultures. So I can talk in general about that and say that they would have qualities of both the woodland tribes and the plains tribes because of their unique location, I guess, in the state of Iowa. So on the eastern side, if you were to examine their life ways, it would resemble more of what we would think of in terms of the life ways of the woodland tribes of the eastern parts of the country. But then as the Iowa moved farther west, they did engage in buffalo hunting. And so then there was more of a life way that you would compare to the plains native people. At the location in at Good Earth, which is up in Lyon County, that was really a small city, that was a trading center. And the primary things that were being traded there were pipestone materials and buffalo hides. So I think there's archaeological evidence of bison being killed actually on, you know, within the site of the village itself. It's not really a village. I would call it a city. So, yeah, the Iowa had that, were in that kind of middle ground in a way and had a variety of life ways, I guess, among Native people.
So one of the problems with being betwixt and between like that is that you have rivals and competitors from all sides. And so can you talk a little bit about who at least the competitors would be? I'm sure sometimes they were rivals, sometimes they were not, but at least who would be the other tribes around them that they would have had to have some kind of relationship, good or bad, with.
Right. And I don't know. There's an attempt to also, I think, years ago there was an attempt to sort of portray Native people as warlike or whatever. And it's not as if there weren't conflicts. But, you know, as people were pushed onto reservations and they had fewer resources to just live their everyday life, that's when a lot of the conflict really began, both in terms of the Iowa with other tribes and conflicts within the tribe itself over, you know, what should they do in the face of what was happening. In the historical record, at least, we've seen conflicts off and on with between the Iowa and the Osage. Also the Sioux. There was a conflict with the Sioux that was in connection with pipestone, actually, in that area there. So I don't know a lot about that, and there isn't a lot of documentation on it. But, yeah, there were disagreements among Native people from time to time.
And I was just really thinking of who else might have been around, because those trading routes are equally as important, if not in a realistic sense, more important than whatever times where conflicts occurred. You still have to have other folks that you're doing business with, and you still have to have those relationships have to have some sort of structure to them in some way. So that's kind of what I was more getting at, you know, than warfare, quote unquote, whatever we want to call that.
Yeah, there was a real trading network among Native people, because you find here in the Midwest, I know when we were up at La Crosse, you know, they were producing materials that were found at sites up there connected to the Iowa that were materials that could only be gotten from the coasts. So these materials were moved around and they were traded, and it was a sophisticated system.
Terry.
Yes. Kelly, you mentioned that the Iowa were removed in the 1830s from their homeland. Where were they relocated, and are their descendants still living there today?
Living where they were removed to?
Yes.
Okay. Yes. So Iowa, unlike Missouri, had a very orderly removal of Native people. Now, that doesn't mean there wasn't somebody somewhere in the state, but it's just that they made a real effort to remove every Native person they could from the state of Iowa prior to settlement. In Missouri, which is where the Iowa were initially removed to, they were at the time of sort of being removed onto the reservation, they were in what's called, what we now call the Platte Purchase area of northwestern Missouri. And they were removed to a reservation that sits near the city of White Cloud now. And it's, you know, on the border, Kansas-Nebraska border in northeast Kansas. So the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, which is a federally recognized tribe, is still at that location. Later, around the late 1870s, 1880s, a portion of the tribe wanted to try to continue living a traditional life. And so they left that area in Nebraska and Kansas and relocated into Indian Territory in Oklahoma, where they had no land, but the Sac and Fox tribe took them in. And then after a few years, they were actually given some land there. And that's near Perkins, Oklahoma. And the Iowa Tribe of Oklahoma remains in that location today.
Ed.
Kelly, do we know how heavily inhabited central Iowa was? And the reason I ask is because the original assays on that big swath of central Iowa, which was almost pure wetland, was that it was uninhabitable and unfit for agriculture. And if, and that swath of land, that swath of soil runs up into southern Minnesota. And of course, until it was drained, it really wasn't. But there were an awful lot of mosquitoes and wetlands there. Do we have any sense of whether the Iowa and others may have just gone in on a day to hunt or whatever and then come back out? Or do we know if they were permanent residences in that area?
That's a great question about central Iowa, and I would have to say I don't know the answer to that. Someone in our film talks about Iowa prior to settlement. And, you know, it was a giant prairie, and we did have, there were a lot of wetlands. It's been said by, I think, Lance Foster, who's the Tribal Historic Preservation Officer at the Iowa Tribe of Kansas and Nebraska, that the state of Iowa is the most transformed state in the Union, you know, from its original condition. And you don't get a sense of what Iowa was like unless you're in kind of the four corners of the state. And also, it's hard for us to imagine now just the incredible sea of prairie that it was, and an utter lack of trees, which is hard to imagine.
Yeah. Yeah,
some of us would describe Iowa as the most disturbed ecosystem on the planet, but I think that's another show.
Yeah, and can be debated, unfortunately. Kelly, I'm interested. You've talked about pipestone three or four times already. I'm not sure everybody knows what pipestone is or what it's good for, and certainly they don't know why Native peoples might have valued it.
And value it even to this day. If you've been, you can go there now, of course, and visit, and you will find that there are Native people actively mining by hand pipestone. So the product of those of that operation, this pipestone is a kind of an easily shaped red stone. It's not crumbly like sandstone, but it's the type of stone that can be kind of worked. It can be you can use tools to scrape it and shape it. And the kinds of things that have been found around the state of Iowa include primarily ceremonial pipes. So the part of the pipe that you'd be putting the tobacco in, that's made from pipestone. There are also these incredible tablets that are quite large, some of them, but that have art depicted on them. And other smaller kinds of materials, but it's a kind of a sacred item and a ceremonial item. And it was highly prized not just by the Iowa, but by many of the tribes, you know, that occupied what we think of as the Middle West. So because they were the stewards of the quarries for a number of years, that was a place that was kind of a neutral zone, so to speak. So if you had issues with the Iowa. Well, you left your guns at the door, let's say, or at outside the park, the quarry. So it was a place of peace and a place that native people honored. And as I mentioned, the Blood Run site, which is now called Good Earth, that's south and just a little bit west of there, and that was a big trading center for that product, for that material, pipestone.
Okay, Terry.
Yes, I'd like to piggyback on that, Kelly. So you mentioned about the pipestone and some of the artifacts that have been found, like ceremonial pipes and tablets. What other artifacts have people found that show that the Iowa were here? And is there a museum or museums that house some of those artifacts so that people can visit?
That's a complicated question. You would think that the largest repository of cultural artifacts related to the Iowa would be in the state of Iowa.
But it's not.
It's not. They're actually in the Milwaukee Public Museum. And these are items that were collected by a man named Skinner. And so it's a full range of items having to do with ceremonial pipes, household type items. Trying to think what all that there were bundles. Those were kind of sacred bundles. So those would be things that leaders would have and would have various purposes. Many of the items we were able to view at the Milwaukee Public Museum, and those are depicted in the film. And there were many things that would have required special permission, and we just didn't seek that permission for sacred or ceremonial items like the bundles or the pipes. Those things we haven't seen. Other than that, there's a lot of the archaeological evidence is really connected more so to their ancestors, the Oneota, who made pottery in a particular way using crushed shell as a tempering agent. And that pottery can be found all over the Middle West. And so that's the kind of evidence that we find. The village or occupation sites, I know when we were, for example, we were driving to the Iowaville site and we came into an area and it was just kind of a beautiful open area. It was on the Des Moines River and, oh, well, that was the site. I mean, a good site then is a good site now. And a lot of these places are where there are cities now. La Crosse is one of those examples.
Okay. Ed.
Yes. Kelly, how bloody was the removal of the Iowa Indians from Iowa? I mean, we all mm-hmm. learned in Iowa history about the Spirit Lake Massacre, which even in sixth grade, some of us could tell who had been pushing who around. And,
right.
And such. But how bloody was it?
Not much with the Iowa. So most of that kind of conflict, the physical conflict, occurred actually in Missouri. And in the first Iowa film, we kind of tell the story through the eyes of two contemporary Iowa leaders, White Cloud, who's also called Mahaska, and someone that he regarded, it seems, as a brother almost, not an actual brother, but a man named Great Walker. So in 1824, the federal government brought the Iowa leaders to Washington, D.C., and that was sort of a routine that they had. The idea was to show Native people the extent of white culture and its presence and its power in Washington, D.C., so that they understood what was coming and that they would be more amenable to signing treaties. So in 1824, they signed a treaty that ceded for the first time Iowa land. And I understand that often they weren't provided with correct translations or sometimes not any translation at all. And so it seems that White Cloud had an understanding of what was happening, and his thought was that he could not defeat this enemy, and he was trying to preserve his people, the lives of his people. Great Walker's response to it when he realized what had happened was to rebel against that. And so there was some physical violence that occurred between Great Walker and his band of followers over the next few years. I think within 7 years, he had been actually killed by in a battle with the Sioux. And so that was how it happened. It happened very, at least with the Iowa, it was very orderly, and there wasn't really bloodshed involved, and especially not in the state of Iowa. It didn't happen there that we know of.
All right. We're going to have to wrap this segment up, but before we do, it is customary that we give our guests the last word on the show. So, Kelly, why do you think knowing about the Iowa tribe is relevant in today's world?
So I'm going to issue the usual cliche about history, which is that we can't really know who we are or where we're going if we don't know where we've been. And even though this is a Native story, this is American history, it's Iowa history, and so we're part of that sweep of history ourselves. And so it's also an unpleasant chapter in American history, and yet it's something that we need to examine. We need to acknowledge what was good and bad about it, and try to move into the future with those lessons learned.
When we come back, we're going to wrap things up. Please stay tuned. This is ROI on KALA St. Ambrose University, 106.1 FM.
You're listening to Relevant or Irrelevant. This series is produced at St. Ambrose University's KALA Radio and has been honored by the Midwest Broadcast Journalists Association and the Iowa Broadcast News Association for excellence in public affairs journalism. You can hear this edition of ROI and many previous programs in this series by visiting Spotify, Google Podcasts, SoundCloud, plus Apple Podcasts. ROI airs Friday nights at 9:30 p.m. on KALA HD2 and can also be heard at 106.1 FM in the metropolitan Quad City area. You can stream this show every Friday night at tunein.com. Search for KALA HD2.
This concludes our 557th show of ROI, Relevant or Irrelevant. Our producer and engineer is Dave Baker. Our program manager is Rick Sweet. And the theme song for our show is titled Kayla's Theme and was written and performed by Mark Zapp Zabital. My name is Jay Swords. We'd like to thank our guest, Kelly Rundle, a documentary filmmaker, and we've been talking about his film series, The Iowa Lost Nation. History buffs for today were Terry Toppler and Ed Broders. This is ROI on Relevant or Irrelevant at KALA. The views expressed on this show are not necessarily those of St. Ambrose University or KALA. We would like to wish all of our listeners to experience the great Basutu proverb, Hotsa Pula Nala, peace, rain, and prosperity. And remember, historians are horrible fortune tellers. Good night.